Welcome to, that's where you go,
Teacher Tales.
There you go. I'm joined today, welcome to
Teacher Tales.
I'm joined today by everybody's favorite, Josh Bryant. He is my nephew from, Lord, I'm going to get this wrong, somewhere in New Mexico. Josh, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself? Talk about your journey into teaching, how you discovered that passion within you to do it, and then talk about anybody along the way that helped you get started in the profession.
Well, it's good to be here with you, Uncle Glenn, and I started out wanting to be a teacher. I'm 37 years old or something. I don't even remember. And I've got a beautiful wife. I've got 4 kids. We live in Las Cruces, New Mexico, and I I'm a music teacher. Right now I teach orchestra. I'm the head orchestra director and one of the assistant band directors at the school that I'm with. And growing up, we were in church. We were always doing activities. School was a very important part of our life. Grew up as a rural ranger in the Assemblies of God. And that's really where the start of kind of people who are younger than me or really wanting to teach and, hey, I learned something cool. And so I'm going to share something with.
So let me interrupt you and ask you a question about your exploits as a Royal Ranger. So did you know that your Uncle Glenn was a quarter finalist for the 1983 Ranger of the Year National Award?
Really? I did not know that.
I was one of the final 4. I finished 4th in the running in 1983 Ranger of the Year. Yep,
that's very cool.
I've got a few ribbons somewhere.
I think the farthest I went, I got runner up in our. It wasn't well district. I made it to regionals several times, and I finished 4th. 1 year, and then I was a runner up. And I don't even mind losing to this kid. This kid was awesome. And it was just we lost by, I think, point 0.2 of a point or something like that. But it's, Rangers going on and getting the gold medal of achievement and going in and being a part of that upper echelon of
really push leadership.
Yeah, raising up young Christian men and creating the environment in which kids can learn. That starts at a very young age. So I remember at the, 13, 14, 15 years old, really starting the discipleship of and honing my own discipleship skills, my own teaching skills with these young men. We would go and teach the straight arrows at that time in the Buckaroos, and my dad being heavily involved, it was a really important adventure. And he taught me that entire process, meeting the other men and the other teachers that I was very privileged, a man by the name of Bart Garrison. He was my senior commander from the time I was 5 until I became a GMA. And so men like him invested in large quantities parts of their life. And that is probably the thing that sticks out to me the most. Just about the experience of teaching, it was something a lot more than just the title and going to school and becoming a teacher. It was becoming a disciple and discipling these students, whether it be in the Bible or whether it be in music. Discipleship and the process of that and coupling that together, really investing in the lives of my students, really investing in the lives of their families and helping them to know and understand, hey, that teacher he's not just a good man. He's not just a good teacher. He really, when he speaks, he's truthful and honest, and I can believe everything that comes out of his mouth. Well, how do you know that? There's so many liars and deceivers and stuff like that. And there's a lot of really fun teachers who don't actually care about their students. And I endeavored really that's to never be that person. I wanted to be someone that everyone understood, hey, this is the real deal. He's a real human being, and he's going to care about his, not just about his test scores or test, you know, worry about the articles that prove that he's a good teacher. He's going to touch someone's heart and spirit, and he's going to really, be something a lot deeper.
So you're there in New Mexico, and I'm not real familiar with, I know that typically speaking on a national, if you look at national trends, New Mexico is typically considered a liberal state.
Mm-hmm. Very.
Not a lot of red on the map in New Mexico. What's it been like for you to live your faith? While you're doing your job,
so we're down in the southern part of the state. We're right next to the border. In fact, lots of people say, "Oh, I live near the border." I can drive 30 miles in one direction and cross over into the Mexican border at a major port of entry in El Paso, and so that gives you context. El Paso and Las Cruces, New Mexico, we touch, and so living with that. As well as being in a purple, I wouldn't say that we live in Doña Ana County, which is it's a retirement. Lots of people who are moving from California, they come in, and it's a lot like Los Angeles of the 1960s, 50s. You know, very small town. We have a lot of people, a lot of landmass, but it, there's only about 70,000 people that live and work in the area, whether it be on the military base the army base that we have at White Sands, whether it be, in El Paso and they commute all the time, whether it's in Holloman Air Force Base, we've got a ton that live 70 or that work 70 miles away, but live here. So we've got a very rural, ideologically rural area, small town feel with a lot of retired individuals that bring in the leftist sort of liberal sort of mindset.
People that are raising a family are probably more local.
Absolutely. They're the ones that are going to be here long term. And so the students that we have, we've got about 30 elementary schools, 30 schools in general. And then we've got 6 middle schools, proper middle schools. When I say proper, I'm 6th, 7th, 8th grade middle schools. And then we've got 4 major high schools of about 1,500 to 2,200 apiece. I work at the largest high school. It's called Oregon Mountain High School. And in kind of a story of that, during all of the BLM riots and during all of the pressure to, assaults on historical figures and historical landmarks. Our school used to be called Oñate High School, named after Don Juan de Oñate, the Spanish conquistador. And so that kind of got caught in the crosshairs. We've got 4 board members for our school board, and they put out a survey and said, hey, we'll change the name if you want us to change the name. And I think the last number was 70 to 80% of the respondees said, don't change it. We don't want it to be changed. It doesn't matter to us. It's, we know that, all the conquistadors were murderers and all of these horrible things, but
this is our conquistador.
It's just a name. I mean, most of the people that I talked to about it were like, it's just a name. There's bad people who were named Hitler. And you know what? We don't hear about anyone who was named Hitler. There's lots of Hitlers that ran before the Hitler that we think about. There's still Mussolini's running around in Italy. Are we just going to get rid of them? So that was kind of the mindset. The people who are smarter about it.
As an Alabamian who's interviewing somebody from Oregon Mountain High School, I can spell Oregon Mountain. I don't know that I'd ever be able to spell that other one.
Well, now which organ? It's the musical instrument organ, and so we get the state or spelling of organ all the time. But so teaching in the middle, that's kind of a rabbit trail, but that kind of gives you a mindset. They ended up changing it anyways, even with the vote coming back. Most of the people in town don't really want to change the name. And so as far as being very liberal we're very proudly, I guess, 50th, 51st. I think Puerto Rico just overtook us in terms of education on that whatever level. Our kids are the, we are, to describe it perfectly, we are a state with lots and lots of Catholics, lots of good people who, we're probably 75% Hispanic. So the white people, you know, I'm a minority by far. I would say there's less than 10% of white people in the district, whether it be teachers, staff, students. I mean, we're very, very, well, it's probably, you know, if it's 75% Hispanic, it's 24% white, and then, you know, 1% other minorities or other races. And so coming from that angle and that perspective, you think of every liberal way of thinking about things, and that's the tact that's taken. There's really no exception in that regard. And so there's a lot of people who just kind of go along to get along, a lot of good people who are good Christian people that just go, great, our state is still, you know,
how badly blue. Can you hear that car revving outside my window?
I can hear it pretty good. It's going to make for good feedback. You want to?
Yeah, we've got a neighbor across the street who, for whatever reason, thinks loud pipes are a great idea.
Oh yeah, those are. Is it a single or a double stack?
Yeah, he's got a little car and he's proud of it.
That was a car. Oh.
Yeah, no, it's a car.
Oh, okay, but no worries. But as far as the liberal mindset, you're talking. We definitely are more involved in the socioeconomic side of things. We consider everybody who is poor, which we've got a lot of poor people. We give, I have seen more 504s given it since COVID. I think every student of mine has a 504 in some form or fashion. And until this year was actually the first year that we reinstituted the 0% policy. It used to be if you didn't go to class, didn't go to school, didn't do a single lick, you still got 40% of whatever percentages that we could give you. And so the baseline was 40%. And so students, really awful students, when I say awful, I'm talking academically.
Yeah, no, students academically, that aren't going, I understand. To. Yeah.
Students that aren't you know, engaged in the process, they would come to school once a week. They would do one assignment, and with that, they would score a D, and then they would graduate. And that was really the holdover from the COVID policy that we did not get rid of. With much screaming and backlash from our leadership, because they didn't want that, because it brought down their graduation numbers.
Yeah, and because it's hard. I mean, it's a tough, decisions are hard. And telling somebody who's been allowed to be a slacker, hey, you're not going to be able to be a slacker anymore, is hard.
Absolutely.
And they're going to get angry, and they're going to write an email, and and, you know, goodness gracious.
Yep.
Yeah.
Well, that's
been true leaders. True leaders have to step in and make the tough decisions.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and it's one of those things where the school districts and the state is trying to raise children and trying to raise families. And that's the biggest struggle that I see as a Christian and as a father and as, you know, a family man. At some point, parents are going to have to step up and take ownership over the teaching of their kids and say, the state is not responsible for my kids. I am. The school district is not responsible for teaching my kids how to read and write and arithmetic. I am. I'm the first line of defense, and I'm the last line of defense. I'm the only one that's responsible for them. And so that's been the biggest struggle for me. Is at one point I've been told, hey, you would be a great administrator. You should, you've got people skills and people like you. And I absolutely not. Never. I will not, because then I will. Well,
I spent about 20 years in the classroom, and well, 14, 15 years in the classroom. And I decided, you know, saying never, never, not me. That's somebody else's. But, you know, and I will say that about administration is a lot like working in the classroom. It's a calling. And yeah. When you know, if you're called, you won't be able to say no. But if you're not called, to try to push yourself into it, it would be, I think it would be detrimental. But, you know, back to where you got started. So you always wanted to know, you're a good Royal Ranger. You always wanted to, you knew you kind of wanted to lead folks. So talk about getting into education and how you got started in education and that kind of thing.
Well, you know, there was a band director. I was from Alamogordo High School, and Alamogordo High School of the 80s and the 90s was really, really great band program, really great football program. We were state champions, runner up. We would win all these awards, our band would. I knew very early on that I was not, that football wasn't going to be a big thing for me. You know, I think I was 4'10" when I was a freshman in high school, and weighed all of 80 pounds soaking wet with rocks in my shoes. And I loved baseball. I broke my leg when I was a junior. And so it was like, and I was on the JV team. So I wasn't, you know, coach wasn't trying to put me in. My daddy didn't make enough money. That would be too political. But, you know, it was one of those things where, you know, you kind of have a come to, well, what are you good at? My dad asked me, what are you good at? And I said, well, it's not, I'm not going to be an engineer. I'm decent in math. I'm taking AP classes and thankful that they're, you know, graded above because I'm getting a C. So it's going to look like a B on my transcript. I was grateful for that. I didn't want to be an English teacher. So many papers that I would have to write. That's just no fun for me. I'm not going to do science. I barely passed biology and chemistry. What am I going to do? Well, you've got to go to college. Okay. Well, I like band. And so it started out, you know, freshman year, I wasn't even going to join band. My dad and mom said, hey, you just give it a year. I was like, marching band's going to be hard. I don't want to do it. And then I was sold.
Yeah. And I don't want to, you know, rain on your parade. How good of a musician did your father say that he was?
Oh, he said he was terrible. Yeah, he said,
he's the bright spot of the family when it comes to music, because none of the rest of us, you know, couldn't carry a tune in a bucket. So he's the one we tell everybody was brilliant at band.
Well, fantastic. He says that he was a pretty good baritone holder.
I would say that's accurate, but you know, I'm little brother looking up to big brother who's finishing something, doing something, being a part of something bigger. And so, you know, we just assumed that because he was in the band, he was awesome.
Well, he is one of the reasons that I, first of all, I mean, I did band out of a deal with my parents. And this tells you how manipulative my parents were. Because when I asked them at the end of the year or later on in my life, I think I was graduating, I said, you know, you remember that deal that you made? I was going in to be a freshman, and you said do band and give it a year. And then I decided that was really fun, and I really liked it, and I stuck with it all 4 years. Would you have actually let me quit? And the answer was immediately no. No, you weren't going to quit. We weren't going to let you do that. We just knew enough about you. We trusted enough in our knowledge that we knew what you were going to actually like and that you were going to really enjoy it. And so, you know, my mom played saxophone in band, and then my dad played baritone and trumpet. I used his trumpet in high school. And so it was not until my senior year that I had a band director that really wanted to look at me as a person and as a musician. And he knew I was no good. I knew two scales graduating high school. But I loved band, and I was at every band event. He tapped me for leadership. I was a trumpet section leader, so I couldn't have been terrible, but you know, I wasn't winning any awards. I was a band president. I was just the spirit behind the band. And it was not really until I can remember, his name was Mr. Bell, and Mr. Bell let me sit in his office, and he put on records or CDs or, you know, we didn't have streaming at that point. You know, we would put on tapes, and he just had a wall, you know, the size of the entire office full of cassettes and CDs and as albums and symphony works. And we would just sit in there, me and a couple of my buddies, we would just sit in there next to the chair. We'd walk in, say, hey, Mr. Bell, and he would be typing something in the corner and hey, can we listen to this? And he's, sure, kids. And he'd put it on there we would just listen. And I remember saying one day, I said, you know, Mr. Bell, I don't know what I want to do, but I want to do band the rest of my life. And he goes, well, here's how you do it. And it was like he had the applications right there. He just reaches in the drawer and he says, he puts it on the table and he says, here, look this over and see if this is something that you would be interested in doing. And I said, yeah, I really like people. I really like music. I really like band. What's not to love about it? And so that was really the starry-eyed, have no idea what I'm about to get into moment where I went, I really like this, and this is what I want to do with my life. And I want to be, I'm, no matter how difficult it is, this is the desire of my heart. You know, we talk about things like that. And if for whatever reason, deep down inside of me, this is the exact place that I wanted to be. And that's the moment that I really looked back and went, I'm going to do this in college. I'm going to start this journey. I had no idea what I was doing, but you know, that's the moment.
And I'm sure from that point to where you are now, it was absolutely, you know, you just graduate from college, go right in, find your band director or find you an orchestra job, and it's all happy and everything's good.
Oh yeah, it was all perfect. You know, from the get go, I was one of those. I loved college so much it took me 7 years. Well, excuse me, I had the opportunity to go for 7 years and graduate. You know, I was
so
not,
you had
I'm
two
not,
redshirt years.
There's a lot of classes, you know.
Yeah,
and that's actually true. I think the most courses I took, there were many courses that I took. I had one 12 credit semester, and that was my first year. And I took four classes. And I said, "This is way too easy. I'm going to four classes a week. This is ridiculous. Let's ramp it up a little bit." And so, from then on, I didn't take anything less than 18 credit hours, and most of my credit hours were 20 and above. The most I ever took was 23 credits, and that amounted to 12 classes. And a lot of them were one credit courses. Like, and so that the music school is no joke. For anyone who may listen to this and you're interested in going into music, it better be something that you want to do. Purely, you have got to be driven. If you get out of there in 4 years, you are incredibly smart and intelligent and organized at a very young age. And God bless you. That's awesome. If you are like me, who I was never really a troublemaker. I didn't like waking up early. And so I skipped a couple of classes here and there, I failed this class, you know, and it racked up. And that's really what happened is I just had, you know, I was good at the classes that I liked, and I didn't apply myself in the ones I didn't like. Acoustical physics was not my friend, and I was, again, not going to be a scientist, and so I didn't apply myself there. But after graduating, at one point, my applied music teacher, that's the private lessons teacher, he probably did the most good for me that he could have possibly done, and he really gave me a reality check. He said, and this was after probably this is the course where you have to learn all of your scales, all 48 scales, all variations of scales, all you have to learn, you know, countless etudes and solos and everything. I wasn't going to be trumpet player extraordinaire. That's what I went to school with, was the trumpet. And he looked at me point blank and he said, you know, it might be time for you to choose a different career. You're not going to make it here. And that jostled me. I'd never been bad at anything in my life. You know, I wasn't excellent at everything, but I had never failed that bad that someone that I really looked up to and really cared for would say really, really terrible things. You know, that's a horrible thing. This is the desire of your heart. This is where you're going to go. You're not going to make it. You're not going to be any good. And I remember I went home and cried. And I called up my dad and I said, Dad, I don't know what else I'm going to do. This is the bridge that I have already crossed, and it's already been burnt down. I don't have anything else that I'm invested in that I'm good at, that I know that I'm going to work at 7-Eleven my whole life. And I remember Dad saying, he goes, well, son, that sounds awfully defeatist, and I didn't raise you to be that way. And I said, well, Dad, that you're being kind of mean, you know. And he goes, no. That's just not the way that I raised you. And you've got two choices here. You can make either way, and it will be good either way, but you've got two choices. And he said, you know, the obvious choice, you can go work at Allsup's, or you can go work at, Allsup's is a gas station chain, by the way, in New Mexico.
Okay.
You can go, You
I didn't know that. We would say Bucky's.
Yeah, there you go. You can go work at Bucky's, or you can go work. You can prove him wrong. And I made up my mind to prove him wrong. And he had, at that point, I had already frustrated my teacher. He had passed me off to graduate students. And fortunately for me, there's a man by the name of Kenny Capshaw. He's a Texas Bandmasters Association Hall of Fame teacher. Used to teach at Coronado High School here in El Paso, world-class music band teacher. And he had just retired and was going and teaching part of the jazz bands. Looking back retrospectively, it was one of 2 years that he taught there before he left for greener pastures back in El Paso. And I was very fortunate to have him my final year as my teacher, because he was very hard on me, but he also told me the truth. He said, I know that you're not going to be a world-class trumpet player, but unless you learn how to apply yourself and act like one and discipline yourself as if you're going to be one, you're never going to have the wherewithal to be a teacher. You're never going to have the wherewithal to go day in, day out with all the different variations of student that you're going to have. You're never going to be able to accomplish that goal. And so your goal of being a great and wonderful band teacher who's going to effectuate change in so many hearts and minds of students, and on top of that, have a great band program, unless you learn and learn how to learn, you're never going to make it. And that was something that was very difficult for me to apply, was, Josh, you have got to learn the stuff you don't want to learn.
Yeah.
You know, I was the only student that
is yourself.
Yeah. Yeah. And I know that you've never had students that were challenging like that. And I know that none of your teachers, you never had them in your school, you know, kids that
I was always that guy that said, no, you ain't going to be able to do this. You need to go find some. Hey, let me have you hand you this Bucky's application on your way out.
And so, you know, I was
the guy
student.
They were trying to prove wrong.
Yeah, there you go. There you go. And so it's teachers
everybody
like
has
you,
a role.
Teachers like you that really helped me understand my place and where I was supposed to be and how I was supposed to conduct myself. It's a difficult lesson, very difficult lesson.
So I have a few questions I'd like to just ask you. We'll run through them as quickly or as slowly as you choose. But I typically ask all these questions, the same questions each episode, so that, you know, people know kind of what to expect. So what's the most memorable moment a student made you laugh? And then how did that moment impact your teaching?
Well, okay, so I've taught, this is my 12th year teaching, and I've taught everything from kindergarten, public school to private school, kindergarten up through 12th grade. I've taught history, I've taught government and economics, all of the history, high school history classes, and I've taught music. So I've got just a few beautiful stories. It wasn't my first gig. It was graduated in December because I was such an applied student. And so I took a job in Odessa, Texas. I graduated from New Mexico State University here in Las Cruces. And I got a call in December that was from Odessa for Ector County Independent School District. And I answered. I was like, I don't have any relationship with Odessa, no friends, no nothing. The only thing I'd known is that I'd driven by and it was just oil rigs everywhere. And so they called me and they said, hey, we've got this new initiative and it's for young teachers that we're trying to get. We're adding elementary positions and we want you to offer you a job. And I said, elementary, huh? Yeah, I'm a band guy. I'm going to be a band teacher, you know. I've applied at a couple places. When I applied in December of 2014, there were approximately, let me tell you, there were three jobs available in the entire state of New Mexico for music, two of which were in Clovis for choir positions at middle school, and one was in a little town on the Navajo Reservation in Laguna, Texas, or in Laguna, New Mexico, which is about an hour due west of Albuquerque. Both of which I did not want. You know, the Laguna job was for $14.5, you know, that was the salary, $14,000. And I couldn't live, because I'm not Navajo, I couldn't live on the reservation. And so I would have had to live in Albuquerque for $14,500 across the year.
Yes.
And
tall task.
And so I said, okay, there's no band jobs opening up. It's December. I looked at Texas, all the big Texas gigs, you know, they're already filled. I'm not moving to, you know, the middle of nowhere, Texas, where I don't know anyone, to get a job that's going to pay me $30,000. And I said, so I'm not going to go to Odessa. I'm talking to the guy on the phone, and I said, hey, I'm not, you know, what's your salary? The salaries here are about, at that point, the salaries here were starting base pay was about $38,000. And he goes, well, you know, well, this is a brand new initiative, and our minimum for first time teachers is 54. And I said, okay, where do I sign? And when's the interview? And he goes, okay. So I got set up with that job. That was a half year job between two schools, and it was horrible. And I got...
Yeah, anytime you're having a couple of things, you know, I don't know if they did the same thing in New Mexico they do in Alabama, but if you take a job in, say, December or January, your salary is prorated until the next school year starts.
Yes. Yeah.
So you're making half a year's pay, but it's got to last you 9 months, 9 or 10 months.
Yes. And that's exactly the way, that's the way it is here in New Mexico. And
yeah.
Oh, definitely. You know, I was driving at that point, I was driving a broken down Dodge Neon from, I think it was a 1990 model. And it was, you know, it was doing good to have all four tires on it at the same time.
And the other thing that comes to mind when you're talking about the working at two schools, you know, In one of my previous jobs, I had teachers that worked for me that were responsible. Like I had a band director, a football coach, something else, maybe an ag teacher, something along those lines. They were half time at my school, half time at another school. There is no such thing as half time at a school. You're either at a school or you're not at a school, but there's no such thing as dual allegiance or, you know, I can do both. Nah, you work for one and then you have to go to the other one, you know, as.
Yep. When it was so difficult, it was two elementary schools and yeah, I was teaching at, I think I taught all the fifth grade across all of the groups and I co-taught at one school. And so it ended up being, we ended up combining both of those or both teacherships combined with me, and we co-taught because I had taken one class of elementary pedagogy in music. I didn't, you know, I was gonna my entire career, yeah, you know, that's what
and
I was gonna do.
Clap.
Yeah, and we're talking by the end of it, I was really, because I had learned how to learn, I was playing recorders and teaching recorders and all of those. So there's a lot of fun stories in there. After I left that job, I ended up interviewing for the job. That was actually a godsend. I made the principal. They were opening up three new, as part of that initiative, they were opening up three new elementary schools in Odessa. And I got to work at Dr. Lee Bice Elementary School and open up the school. And so we saw the building process. And I didn't realize it at that point, how precious that was and how cool that was of an experience to be the first teacher in that room. And to set it up the way that you wanted and to buy the equipment and to make sure it's all. I just remember interviewing for that job just like, this is cool. This is so neat. And so it was at that job that I had that funny story where we were doing my boss, her name was Alicia Press. Wonderful. What the best boss I've ever had. And it's not even close. I've got great bosses right now. It's not even close. She's one of my nearest and dearest friends that I know that I could call her up right now with an issue or a problem. And it would be as if I haven't worked for her in 5 years, and it would be as if there is no time lost. She's bought into her teachers, once in a lifetime, you know, being able to work for her and with her. She's super cool. She came up to me. It was the third year that I was there, and she said, "Hey, I you're probably not going to like this." And I said, "What?" And she goes, "Can you do a talent show with the kids?" And I said, of course, you know, that's the type of personality I am. Sure, that would be a lot of fun. And she goes, really? You're not, are you sure? And I said, yeah, I've never done one of those before. Let's go ahead and do it, you know? And so I remember We made it serious. It was right along that same line as like American Idol, and they would guest contestants would come up, and I was the Simon Cowell, you know. And so I sat there. They would come into my room, and I just remember, you know, second graders, you know, standing up there singing, you know, God Bless America in three different keys, and it was just, they were horrible. No stage presence, no nothing. And I ended up narrowing it down to about 15 acts. I remember the sign-up sheet was over 200 kids. Acts,
oh yeah, no doubt.
In a school of eight,
talented in elementary.
Man. So, the funny story. That's not the funny story. This is the funny story. I had two individuals, and they were super shy kiddos that walked into my class, and I, you know, those kids that you have to double take for because they're just out of place, and they're.
Yeah.
Wait a second. You're going to audition. What is your talent? I've never heard you say three words in my class, you know? And so what's your, and it was these two kids, and they were best friends, but they were the odd couple. And so I said, what are we going to do today? And the young girl, she's a third grader. They're both third graders. And she goes, well, I'm going to sing. And she was very matter of fact, I'm going to sing and he's going to dance. And I said, okay, what are you going to sing? Well, and she says, do you have any dinosaur music? And I said, dinosaur music? What is dinosaur music? And she goes, you know, music with dinosaurs. And I said, let's go to YouTube and let's see if I can find dinosaur music. What am I going to? So I'm looking up like Godzilla. I'm looking up Jurassic Park music. I'm looking at, and none of it. And she was just so matter like, no. No, that's not it. No, that's not it. And so finally I was like, okay, I'm going to find something and you're going to dance. You're going to sing to it and you're going to dance to it. Okay. And so fantastic. And I remember finding it was one of the Jurassic Park themes, yeah, super slow motion. And this third grade breaks out into screamo music, just screaming at the top of her lungs. Yeah. Dinosaurs, ah! And she's headbanging. She had long emo hair. She's headbanging. All the while, I'm caught off guard by that. And I look over, and the other boy is dancing in the worst break dancing moves since the 2024 Olympics. I mean, just horrible, horrible. You know, rolling around on the doing these poses, and so I've got these two things going on here. And it was so bad and so long. And it was one of those things where there's a car crash that you just could not, you're watching them converge. And my principal walks it. First of all, I get a radio thing on a radio call. And Mr. Bryant, is everything okay? And I respond, yes. And as soon as I press that button, she lets out this rip-curdling scream. And so it's not 30 seconds later that I've got Alicia running up to my room, and she opens up the door, and I'm just sitting back, and I'm like, I can't stop this. It's already
show. Here
the dominoes. Yeah, the dominoes have already started falling, man. It wasn't funny at the time because I had put everyone on high alert. It sounded like I was slashing kids up or something, But it's just one of those things where every time I talk to her or anyone from the school at that year, that's the one thing they want to talk about is, do you remember those kids? Those kids were just in the dinosaur music. Oh, my goodness. They were so funny. They didn't make the talent show, but it was a lot of fun to call their parents and tell them that they were still alive. So
oh, me. When you said dinosaur music, I thought, surely this child's looking for Barney.
Oh man! Well, we tried that, and it didn't. None of that stuff. None of that. Nope. I still to this day have no idea what dinosaur music is.
So, if you could give your younger teacher self one piece of advice, and only one piece, what would it be, and why did you choose that piece of advice to give yourself?
You know, this is probably of all the questions that you know I knew that you were going to ask. This one is probably the. You're not going to be perfect and your kids aren't going to be perfect and you have to accept it. You have to accept it. Your kids are not going to be perfect. What you ask them to do, they're never going to be perfect in doing that. You may get really close if you're an excellent teacher. If you've got a good group of kids, they may get really, really close to what you're asking them to do, but they're not perfect. They're just kids. That was a difficult lesson for me because I had worked so hard to be where I had where I was, and I was, you know, small amounts of frustration because it's not where I wanted to be, where I felt like I needed to be, or you know, it wasn't a band gig. And even as I was going and applying for these other gigs, these other band gigs where I thought, and I would just get rejected, and no, you're an elementary teacher. We, you know, it's kind of that black hole of success. You know, if you're a really successful elementary teacher, they feel like you can't be successful anywhere else. And so the last thing anyone wants is, you know, Mary had a little lamb on the marching field. And so, you know, administrators are a lot more shy to embrace the elementary side of things, even if you are excellent. And so that was really difficult for me to embrace with myself and with my kids, is that your perfection is out of the question, man. They're just kids. They're not your kids. You can't control them any more than you can control yourself. And so I found that the more control I had over myself and the more expectation I set on myself, the more difficult it was to teach my kids. And so I really had to forgive myself from a lot of my own imperfection. And that seems really silly to even say, but that's really what you have to do. When you're really highly driven and you're motivated to be excellent, you have to forgive yourself when you're not. And you have to forgive your kids when you're not, and you have to understand it. So young Josh, and I'm not so far removed, you know, I'm not retiring anytime soon, but I think that was the first thing that I really expected my kids to do, was be the perfect students, because I was going to be the perfect teacher. And it's not how the world works.
Yeah, I got reminded pretty quickly that I wasn't a very good student back in the day, so I needed to remember that I was trying to teach kids that were like I was back in the day.
Yeah.
I had an administrator take me aside, and he said, hey, because I'm like you. I wanted it to be excellent. I wanted everything I touched to be excellent. And I would work extremely hard to make it that way. But it's so retired Marine. He put his, well, I don't know if he retired, but I know he served 4 years in Vietnam in the Marine Corps, and he put his arm on my shoulder. He said, hey, here's what I want from you. I want the best with what you got. That's all I got. That's all I ask. The best you can do with what you got. And he said, if you'll do all you can with what you have where you are, he said, everything else will be gravy. Don't worry about anything else. So anyway.
That's a good boss right there. That's a good boss.
Yeah, I've had some good ones now. I really have. I was very fortunate. I had some bad ones too, but I was very fortunate to have some guys that really, like your boss that you remember, could call them right now and say, hey, I got this question. What's the right thing to do? And they would tell me, hey, all right, this is going to be the right thing. It ain't going to be the easy thing, but it'll be the right thing.
Yeah.
And that's all you can ask is somebody to be honest with you.
Yep. Well, and it's that idea of leadership. That's so important.
Yeah. What's the craziest thing that you've ever done to keep your students engaged? And more importantly, did it work?
Well, so this was a hard question to answer, because, you know, I never felt like I had to do much trying to get engagement. You know, I wasn't teaching math. Well, I was teaching math through other things, but that wasn't the core. When the kids came, they wanted to be in my class. They were excited to be in my class. So I've never really had to have whereas a common core math teacher would really, really have to come up with some creative ways. I've never had to do that type of suffering the little children to, you know, intellectual and mathematical excellence. But I have done, if there was a crazy thing to be done in the school, Mr. Bryant was involved in it. And that's everything.
It's been true at schools for over 40 years. Well, actually, that's been true of schools since I was about six years old.
It's just,
yeah, anyway, you know, yeah. So if there was some shenanigans, I was a part.
Well, as a student or as a...
Both.
Both.
I've been guilty of both.
Well, I mean, there's never been a party that we didn't have a lot of fun at. You know, so I've done everything from first year. So Vice Elementary opened up, and we got it from the principal, from Alicia. Our school's going to be excellent, and we're going to be excellent because I hired everyone. And everyone is of the same like-minded mindset about student success, whether you're old school, new school. It was a part of that that real initiative that kind of came down the pike, Century Learning Centers, that schools, like new schools were being built, you know, open walls and open classroom, open concepts. And so that's how that school was built. It was built around a hub, a grade level hub. So it was really, really cool school to be a part of. And so it was easy to kind of take it from that traditional hallways and brick and everything's closed off and you can't see anything to, man, you're looking through these creative wall space and seeing these creative spaces go through. You can see from one classroom through all five other classrooms. And you know, the whole time we're being told from, you know, district people, you know, we don't know how it's going to work. Good luck. God bless to all of you. And we didn't know how it was going to work because we'd never been a part of anything like that. So it was a lot of fun. That helped. I think if we had just been going into, you know, a 1950s style school, it would have been a lot more difficult to get that idea of that new 21st century model of teaching where we're basing things off of new science and new or just science. Kids don't learn when they're sitting in a desk for 12 hours a day. You know, they don't learn that way. And so we're getting up, we're moving around, we're going and doing experiments, you know, in one classroom. And so that was a lot of fun and a lot of there was a lot of excitement. Well, there's a lot of responsibility, you know, as a teacher or as an administrator, rather, that if you have really negative people in your specials, that your school suffers. It doesn't really matter if the rest of the team, I mean, it matters, but it's so important that your specials group have the right mindset for their job because it can shape the entire culture of the school. And so that was the thing that we experienced. It was like, the PE coach was this old salty, she's not old. She would kick me in the shins if I ever had uttered that. Miss Minkowski, Renee is one of my dearest friends. And she and I, she would just treat me like the son that she had because I was just there and like, oh, Mr. Bryant, there you go again, trying to like, make the world fantastic. And then we would do it and she would jump on board and it was a lot of fun. And so the first year that I did, I started the whole story and then I got off on a tangent. But the first year I told my principal, I said, Alicia, we're going to join the Christmas parade. And she goes, oh, okay. So you need a trailer or you need kids walking or what do you need? And I said, I already have a semi trailer. I already have, I think I had something like 10,000 lights that I had already prepared and gotten rid. I said, I'm going to put my choir risers up on top of this semi-truck trailer, and I'm going to stick all of my kids on there, all 150 of the choir kids. And she goes, I'm going to have to go talk to the lawyers and make sure that there's no how we limit the liability here. And I said, it's going to be fine. It's going to be great. And so we did it. We ended up scoring first place in the parade, and it was great. I got all 150 on there. I'm sure I broke some sort of law or code or something. But the kids had a great time. It was wonderful. I've worn, I've taken, if there was a pie to be thrown in someone's face, it was almost always me who won. I don't know how you win the ability to be, but I
had that opportunity a time or two myself.
I was winning and I was always, willing to do it.
Was disappointed in the type of pie that they decided to put in my face. Most of the time it was just whipped topping. Well, that ain't really pie.
No.
I mean, all
give
that
me
does
some
is
chocolate
gets,
or something.
Just whip topping up your nose and you smell soured milk for a week. No. I want lemon meringue,
Yeah, give me something that tastes good. But, there was a one time where we had a end of year. We'd finished all of our state testing and we got a huge gong show type variety show that we had. And I wore myself, my principal, and let me tell you, Uncle Glenn, we wore myself, the principal, and one of the second grade teachers, who was formerly a UT, University of Texas cheerleader, who was still in very, very good shape and looked really good in a tutu. We all wore tutus, and we did this routine that she designed just because it would make the kids smile and have fun at the end of the year, because they... Mr. Bryant is very, you know, I'm fun, but I'm serious. I hold my classes to a high standard. And they never thought that they would see me in a pink tutu and tights. And they did. And I'm not sure it was the prettiest thing, but man, they sure did laugh.
I do surely wish I could get a picture of that so that I could, you know, add it
to
the...
I have one. And if my wife...
I don't think that that won't be the thumbnail on YouTube for this interview. Not think for a second that I will not use that.
Perfect.
Yeah,
I think the biggest...
The views, oh, they will come. They will come.
Your ratings have just boosted. There you go.
Yeah,
that's all they want to see is a 20-something-year-old guy in a tutu. That's what they want. Give the people what they want. You know, but I really took, so all of the craziness, and that's just a couple of them, all the craziness that I did, it was all about the team, and it was a lot more about the team that I was working with of teachers if I could make them laugh on a day, then I knew I could make their kids learn. And I knew that it would help their kids if I could make them laugh, if I could make them smile throughout the day, that their kids would be better for it, and they would be better for it, and then the team would be better for it. And that was kind of, so you know, all the crazy shenanigans and stuff like that, I hope that people that I worked with and my coworkers look back on that, and I know that they do, because I've got so many friends from that time in my teaching career. And I just, that's the first thing. We talk about these things. Oh, do you remember when your class did this? Oh, do you remember when, you dressed up like Elvis and all of the fifth graders dressed up like Elvis? And and you, do you remember when we had that concert and we, you know, when you coupled with the PE teachers and you, we had this thing called Star Wars, and you dressed up like Obi-Wan Kenobi, and you had Star Wars music playing, and we hula hooped for 3 hours. Like, do you remember that? It's not really about test scores or anything like that. It was always, could I make someone smile? Could I make someone understand that the kids that they had were precious? Could I help the kids understand that they were precious and that they were valuable? And that's, I feel like I accomplished my goal in all of those. I just hope that people will remember that, because it's, I would do anything to make kids enjoy school.
So, you know, it's not all tutus and Elvis and Obi-Wan Kenobi. There are days that are tough. And so on those days, how do you stay motivated when, you know, you're having that day that nothing seems to go right?
Well, it's my paycheck. I really, you know,
that is hilarious, by the way. I mean, and I don't know about New Mexico, but Alabama has come a long way with respect to teacher salary.
Oh, us too. Us too. You know,
I fussed when I started teaching because you couldn't raise a family on what they paid us. I was talking about, you know, my daughter's a teacher now. It's 30 odd years since I got into the profession. Starting salaries have more than doubled. And I know it's still not what you would make for with a 4-year degree in engineering or this, that, and other. I realize it's still not that, but it pays the bills. I mean, you can make a living on teaching, not drive a Lamborghini, but you can make a living.
you might get a nice Scion if you really work hard. But I, you know, go to the actual question. It's my family. And I know that that's a cliche, but I look at my 4 kids and I look at my wife, and I, when I'm having a hard day, I can go to Lindy and I can say, sweetheart, I'm having a really hard day, or this. She's been a part of, since I became a teacher, the semester that I student taught was the semester that I met her. And when I met her, we were going to a wedding. Farmington, New Mexico is at the northwestern point of the state, and we're at the south central lowest point in the state. And so a buddy of mine who I stood up with at his wedding, and a girlfriend of hers that she stood up with at the same wedding, they were getting married. And we were the only two coming from Las Cruces. And I called up my buddy and I said, hey, that other bridesmaid, she's, you know, she lives down here. Or she drive, how is she getting up there? Because I'm driving up by myself. And he goes, here, let me connect you two. And so I texted her and I said, you know, hey, I'm Josh and whatever. Are you going up to Kyle and Kim's wedding? And she goes, yeah, I was planning on driving. And I said, well, would you mind going together? Let's go. And mind you, I'm not looking for anything. I just gotten out of a horrible, horrible relationship where, you know, one of those things where God delivers you through pain. And and it was an inexplicable timing, only God's timing, because by the time we got, I was an hour late picking her up. We were supposed to leave at 5:30 in the morning. We left at 6:30 because I woke up late. I lost the directions to her house. This was before I had a smartphone or anything like that. And I drove past her house in a frantic, in an Oldsmobile, a champagne colored 1990 Oldsmobile, and flying past her street. And I saw her and the red truck that she described. And I pulled a wheelie illegally, mind you, and pull into her house. She was just,
and
I remember,
she's thinking, wow, let me meet this
what
guy
a,
who's an
what
hour late dropping an Oldsmobile.
And she,
I wonder, does he know he's such a chick magnet?
That was back when I had hair in the right spaces and stuff. So
I found the man. This is the man.
And so she sat with a gun at her feet, you know, in her book bag, the entire trip up there that I was unaware of. And I just remember, you know, I pulled into her and I'm like, oh, I'm sorry. Get out. I'm so sorry. Are you Lindy? And then I remember making eye contact with her. And I just remember going, you are absolutely beautiful. She's going to be pissed off the whole trip. And I, you know, I've just been horrible. And she was so gracious. And she said, oh, that's okay. It's okay. And I said, can I load up your stuff? And she loads it all up. So she wasn't mad. She even brought M&M cookies that she had baked. And I knew then that she was the one, you know, just cookies. And
she said, let me tempt him with some M&M cookies. Teach him to be an hour late.
Well, and so it was really one of those things where, you know, I'm experiencing it and I'm not seeing the providence. I'm not seeing the God's hand and mercy on all of it. We get up to Albuquerque. I hadn't even heard her voice because I had just rambled the whole time because she's a pretty girl and I just talked. But I get
to
Albuquerque.
That's what you sound like.
Yeah, really. And I said, stop for gas, stop for fuel. And my dad, what was that emergency call? Hey, I don't know what she is. I had arranged that with dad. Hey, dad, call me 2 or 3 hours. And so I had ignored that because I'm just chatting up a storm. And I get out and I pump gas and she goes inside and dad calls me. And I just remember going, dad, she is so wonderful. We're going to be just fine. She's a delightful human being. You know, I think her name is Lindy. I don't know because she told me at the very beginning, but I wasn't really, I was running late. But she's beautiful. She's awesome. And so we get up there finally, and we go through the wedding. We end up walking together because I didn't like any of the other bridesmaids, and she didn't like any of the other groomsmen. And so we made a deal that we would walk together. And then when we were on our way home, and I remember dropping her off. We were on time getting home, and I remember dropping her off, and I just said, so I'll see you later. And she goes, okay. And I just remember getting back in the car and going, she's my best friend, whether she knows it or not. She's going to be that. She's going to be my best friend. And I didn't know that it was going to go as far as wedding or anything like that, but I knew that I was just enamored with her. Turns out in Albuquerque, she had texted her best friend that she had met the guy that she was going to marry. So it, you know, it worked out, you know.
The thing is that he was an hour late.
Yeah, he was an hour late. You know, I had to bribe him with cookies. He wouldn't shut up. And, you know, that was the enticing thing
about
him.
That's just proof that the good Lord has somebody in store for everybody.
And a sense of humor.
And the right one.
Yeah. But that's, you know, all of the stress and all of the sadness that comes with the job, and it really is Teaching is not for the faint of heart, and I couldn't do it without Lindy. I couldn't do it without her, and about the kids, and knowing that it, in my broken moments, she's the one that's always been there to help me reassemble myself and be the man that I really am striving to be. She's got the same vision for, in fact, I think she's even got a better vision of the type of man and the person that I actually am than I do in my soul and my spirit. She's more closely to the vision that God has for me than I have, because I know all of my weaknesses, all of my low points. I couldn't possibly be a good man the way that she, you know, and yeah. So that's what keeps me going.
And she sees what you could be and where you can't.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's why God made man and woman to go together.
Yeah.
It's a miracle. I mean, it just really is. Because I know in my case, my vision for myself and LaBeth's vision for me, she's always had a better vision for me than me. And anytime I've said something stupid like, hey, I think I'd like to, and she'd go, hey, you would do a great job at that. Or she's yeah. never once said, no, you can't do that.
Yep.
Yeah. That's out of your reach.
Yep.
You know, anyway. Can you share a time when a student success story reminded you why you became a teacher?
There's a lot of kids that I've, you know, I was thinking, trying to come up with a number, and I'm sure that all teachers at some point, administrators, try to come up with a number of kids that they've had cross their paths. I the number that I was coming up with was somewhere in the 50,000-60,000 range of students that I've either directly or indirectly had an impact with. And you know, there's the kids that go off and you just knew that they were going to be something, and there was really no reason for them to be something. And the fact that you got to be their teacher for a little bit, they probably would have been something even if they had someone else. I've got a student, his name is Sean. I had a student, and I taught him his second, third, and fourth grade year. Pudgy little white kid, pasty white, hair in his face, curls all over the place. People skills didn't really exist. He was a student of one of my teacher friends there at the school. And he was a good kid, really, really smart kid, really, really good kid. But you could tell that if he just got out of his own way, he would be okay. But he didn't have any direction. He again, super smart, but he was very similar to me, where it's like, what else are you going to do? You're not going to be athletic, which you're in Odessa, Texas, man. If you're not good at football or basketball, you're not worth very much, according to a lot of people in that part of the world. And so he was never really a stellar student. Behavior wise, he was impeccable, but he was never really the type of kid that was, you know, you're going to get that recorder solo because I know you're going to play it in tune. You know, he wasn't that kid that was always perfectly in place, but he was one of those students that I really saw more in. And so I took him under, I'd make a point to go and speak to him every day. Speak to me, tell me something about your, hey, Sean, what did you do in math? Hey, how did you like that lesson that Mr. Bryant? And he would always give me good. Oh yeah, it was a little hard. And by the time he was fourth grade, before I left, we were having full-blown conversations. And he's a success story, not just because of what he did after he was my student. He went on to be an all-region middle school horn player, French horn player. And he has since, he made all-state all 4 years of his high school career in Texas, which is, I didn't teach him French horn. That's not, you know, right. I'm not trying to take any of that, because that was all him and his teachers. He's at the Indiana School for Music right now, University of Indiana. Great, the great, great, great school of music, the Jacobs School of Music. And he's making it. He's in their wind ensemble. He is just a success story in that regard. But I don't feel like he would have had that success without having the music teacher talk to him and really, really show him that he was going to be a cool kid. And so he's one that on a base level, I had some finger in the pie of making that music kid, who's, I really believe he's a prodigy. He's just a great human being, and him kind of realizing in himself that, hey, I this music guy, even though he's not cool and he dresses with ties and stuff like that, I really like him, and I wouldn't mind being, I hope that there's a little part of Sean that if he thinks back on me at all, he goes, you know, he was a good man, and I really wanted to be so, he showed me what a good man looks like. And that's a success story. I had another one that, I've had other kids like that, like Kevin. He's a single household, mom's a single earner, nurse working three or four nursing positions. And he's recently gone and joined the military. He's in the Marine Corps, very proud of him. And he came back after he finished basic, and he came to visit me. I was one of the teachers that he had 7 days of shore leave, and he came back to visit me and give me a hug and just show off his uniform. And I, you know, I was the one that showed him how to dress for a concert, and I bought him some black socks and a pair of black shoes that he borrowed, because the black shoes that he wore were Converse or something like that. And I said, here's my shoes, man. You put this on. This is a big jazz gig. You wear these pairs of shoes. And then, you know, I've had Ryan, he's now a drum major. He was a great kid. Again, all of these kids probably would have been just fine without meeting Mr. Bryant. He's a drum major at New Mexico State University, now a flute major. He's going to be a fantastic teacher. And then I've had the other kids that I know I made an impact. And I know that without me, their lives would have been drastically different. There's little, he's not little anymore, but David, he was a first, second, and third grader, and he was being raised by his grandmother because his mom was addicted to meth and his father was abusive. And I was the only person to ever tell him before coming to the school. And his other teachers, I'm sure, but he was a problem kid. He was mean. He had ADD, and he struggled just to stay awake in school. And as a reward, because he liked my class, as a reward for doing well in his other class, I would come and read to him at the end of the day. And when he was in third grade, he and I got very close, and he was very comfortable with me, and he sits over next to me, and he nestles over where he's touching my shoulder. And I said, "What's up, David?" And he goes, "It was Mr. Bryant. You're the first guy that's ever believed in me." And I said, you know, at 27 years old or 30 years old, I don't remember how old I was. And I said, "Well, David, you're worth it, man. You're a good kid. Who has lied to you?" And I talked very plainly to him. And I talked, as I do most of the kids that I teach, I said, "Buddy, there are truths and there are lies. And if you believe lies about yourself, it doesn't make them truths. You are a brilliant, smart young man, and you're going to do something, and you're going to be a good kid." And I don't know where he's at. I know that he went through fifth grade. I know that he went through middle school, and I know he had started his high school career. And I know that through middle school, he had A's and B's because I know his teachers. And they were friends of mine. They told me, because I would ask him all the time.
So you've touched on it a little bit. That is why I felt like I was called to public school, is because you can have those impacts where you can't do that everywhere. But in public school, the need is so great that and it is not a very daunting task to say, "I believe in you."
Yeah.
It's not hard, because I can assure you. And this was a hard lesson for me to learn too, because I didn't have to struggle much as a kid. Now I created a whirlwind of chaos wherever I went, but I didn't have to struggle. You know what I'm saying? We were poor, but we didn't know it.
Yeah.
But we weren't allowed to act poor. We weren't, you know, all of that. But I will say this, there's not a kid anywhere, regardless of what their nationality of their parents, regardless of what their nationality, you know, all of that. There's not a child anywhere who chooses their proximity to your school. Every one of them that is an adult's made that decision for them. And you just need to take it as God's will for you to come across their life and impact it in some way.
Yeah.
That's good.
I mean, there's you know, there's so many stories that I can tell of either myself or situations that I know of and were privy to, or ones that didn't happen directly to me, but I was on the periphery of it. And there's God puts you in places where you are needed.
I had a
student of mine, his name was Landon, and this is probably the most traumatizing thing that I've ever as a teacher, because it didn't happen while I was actually teaching. I was at that same elementary school, and I lived in an apartment complex, and after Lindy and I got married, we just kind of moved into a larger apartment in that, because houses were expensive, and it was the end, it was 2015, 2016. So the housing markets were really, really crazy. And a lot of stuff was kind of going on. Housing there was really expensive. A hole in the wall garbage house was running anywhere from $300,000 to, or $250,000 to $400,000. And just because of the area, we lived in this apartment complex, and a lot of my students, or at least the students that I serviced, were in and around those apartment complex. And there was one lived in the same building as that. Well, in the next building on the corner, and we lived on the second story. And so I would see him all the time outside playing in the yard, and that we built up a routine pretty much. After school, I would get home and I would wave at him, you know, as I'm parking the car and stuff. And one night it was about 10 o'clock. And it was atypical for Lindy and I to, unless we had gotten home late, I took the dog out atypically to go to the restroom and out for a walk, and which was atypical because the place that we lived wasn't terribly good. You know, you don't go out after a certain time of night. And so I decided, I was like, well, I'll just take her for a quick walk around the block. And I was walking on the way back to the house, and Landon comes running out of their downstairs apartment, and he's screaming at the top of his lungs, and he's going, "Someone, please help me, help me, help me. My mom is, my help." And I was right there, and I said, "Landon, what's going on, buddy?" And he goes, "Mr. Bryant." And he just buries his head in my stomach. And he was in second grade at that time. And he goes, my mom is on the floor. And I said, okay. So I go into the house, and there's Dad, and he's resuscitating Mom. The mom had OD'd on pills, and everything was out there, and she's laying in her own puke. And I just said, Dad, I'm Mr. Bryant. I knew him because I had talked to him. And I said, "I'm Mr. Bryant. I've got him at my house. Here's my number." And I wrote down my number, and I sheltered Landon, and I put him outside, and I said, "Hey, buddy, everything's going to be okay, man. We're going to be okay. We're going to get through this." And I write down my number real quick, and I put it on the thing, and I say, "Has the police been called?" And he goes, "Yes." And I said, "I'm going to call the ambulance." And he goes, "I've already called them." I said, "I'm going to call again so that they know it's serious." And he stayed with us that night because his mom died. And if I hadn't have been there, he would have been running out in the street getting hit. He ran into the street past me because he was just crazed. And you know, that type of providence, I look for God's grace everywhere. And that's the only thing that I think, if that young boy survives through trauma like that, of watching his mom, obviously there was something going on, watching his mom die. And I've told Lindy that story, and I obviously told, you know, the people who work. But I don't tell that story often, and I don't tell it lightly, because he trusted me, and he fell asleep on my lap, and I was just holding him, and he was holding on to me because I was his lifeline. And that type of ability, that I don't deserve that. I didn't do anything special to deserve stuff like that. But that's a precious thing to know that you're trusted that way. And it's a precious thing to know that God trusts you enough to use you in that manner in a time where it is mass chaos and pandemonium and questions and horrible thing.
Yeah, it's similar, not as close to what you're, but very similar. And I always tried to make school a place where, I hate to use the word, make it a safe place, But to make more than that, I wanted kids to have connections with adults that, you know, that transcended the classroom. So when I was previous school, I retired from a high school, but I was at a, started a PA school over in Huntsville City. Sunday afternoon, my texts go crazy. Hey, are you watching the news? Are you watching the news? No, I'm not watching the news, but I will. So I flip on the news, and it's the parents of one of our students. And it was not uncommon for the parents of one of our students to be on the news, something true. But this young lady's father had been in a shootout and had gotten shot and killed in their driveway. Now, she's a seventh grade female, Sunday afternoon, 5 o'clock. So we reach out. We have kind of a crisis intervention team that teachers, special ed teachers, especially, if it involved their students. It's amazing how a lot of times that correlated to special ed students. But at any rate, not our crisis intervention team reached out to the parents and said, she's fine. Everything's good. May it be a couple of days before we see her, but she's fine. And I said, hey, take as long as she needs. I said, and we'll have special counselor come in for her if we need to when she comes back. 7 a.m., I'm the one that greets the buses when they arrive on campus. And so I'm out there greeting, you know, buses arriving on campus, because they make two loads. They'd circle around. It was a city school. But anyway, an interstate made it where they had to ride a bus, even though we're a mile away. So first kid off the bus, this little girl whose dad had been shot the night before. And I said, sweetheart, come here. I go over there and I said, hey, are you okay? She goes, yeah. I said, you know, you didn't have to come to school today. And she said, I mean, I will never forget it, but it brings chills. She said, Mr. Bryant, she said, I'm going to be honest with you. She said, this is the safest place I know. Hey, it's school.
Yeah.
But, yeah. You know, she just knew that we cared. I mean, you know, that we would not let anything. And she needed a distraction from all the.
Yeah.
And so we just kind of asked her teachers to say, hey, keep an eye on her. If she says that she, I told her, I said, hey, I'm going to tell your teachers. All you got to do is say you need to come see Mr. Bryant, and they're going to let you come. And I didn't see her that day, though. She just, she wound up. But now, I would love to say that that story has a happy ending. Unfortunately, the environment took her, too. So eventually, it was just a rough, you know, it was not. She was a great kid, but in a tough circumstance that I don't know that we had the right answer for it.
Yeah.
But anyway, I digress. What's the funniest misunderstanding or miscommunication you've ever had with a student?
Hey, you know, our segues, maybe we should talk differently about our segues.
Yeah. Thank goodness for editing.
Yes. Well, as I was thinking through this, I couldn't find just one. And miscommunications happen on a daily basis when you're teaching, you know that. And, you know, I had a student one time. So, I used to do, I'm a little bit like you, I guess it's a Bryant thing. I liked the lunch duty. I liked the cafeteria duty. I liked the bus duty, all of the ancillary things that are within and outside of the job description that you just have to do. And so I love those things because that gave me an opportunity. I didn't feel like I was teaching, even though I was teaching them how to speak and how to talk and how to deal with people and deal with crisis and all of those things. And so this one instance,
I'm going to have to pause just a second.
I'll
be right back.
No problem. And turned on all my lights. All right. Can you hear me?
All right. I'm back. Can you hear me?
Yes, sir.
I can't hear you now. Let me see what I've got going on.
Uh-oh.
Are you on mute?
No, I'm not. It's coming out.
I can't hear you a lick.
Uh-oh. Here.
Can you hear me? Yeah, I can't hear you.
All right.
Let me check my settings right quick and see if I've somehow I've goofed something up.
Testing. 1, 2, 3, check. Test. Everything's on.
There's my FaceTime camera. Let me try disconnecting these headphones and see if that helps.
Okay. Try the...
Are you still there?
Yes. Can you hear me?
Can you hear me now?
Yes, I can hear you.
Dumb. It's the problem. Now it's...
Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Test.
Hey, I'm going to end this session, and then we'll start right back with another one, okay?
Okay.
Now, wait, I hear you.
Testing?
Yeah,
can you
I'm
hear
good.
That? Awesome.
I hear you.
Great.
Just have to make sure we're not getting an echo. Use my old cheap microphone right here. $1 special. All right. I'm going to go back to the question I asked originally, And then we'll go there. What's the funniest misunderstanding or miscommunication you've ever had with a student?
There you go. Can you hear me?
I can.
All right. Cool.
Were you on? Were you?
That time the mute came up.
All right.
All right. I'm sorry.
Now I can hear you.
Fantastic.
Hey, you know, we've been going an hour and a half. It feels like
really?
We just started.
Well, we should do this more often so we don't have to talk so long.
We should. So,
take three.
What's the funniest misunderstanding or miscommunication you've ever had with a student?
So, I had this student one time, and he was in second grade, and he was on the spectrum of some sort, ADD. He was a very imaginative kid, very, very imaginative kid. He was the kid that would come, and he had concocted a whole fantasy in his head while he's having a conversation with you, and it's a very simple thing. Did you do this? And he would go, what? And he, okay, so that's the type of kid he is. And he's not a ill-behaved kid. He's not a bad kid. And he certainly didn't have any of the problems that I'm about to describe right now, or at least I didn't think he had these problems. So we were at recess, and it was right before recess, and I would walk out from my class. I'd finish up my class, clean up my stuff, and then go into the gymnasium with the PE. Now, the PE that we had at this elementary level was grade level PE. So you're talking 100 kids in each grade level. And so there's 100 kids. They each had their spot on the ground that she had painted on, and they had already been in trouble. Okay. And so coach's way, it was coach and a coach's aide. She would just be like, everybody on a dot. And so you would go to the dot, and if you were off the dot or talking, you would run a lap, and you had to do it quietly. She was hardcore. Okay. She'd been teaching for 25 years. And so she could get away with stuff like that. And so they were in trouble, and no one was running, and it was silent in that gymnasium. And you know how echoey things get, right? And so I'm over there being a Nazi as well, you know, walking around. Where is everybody? Okay, making sure everyone's on their spot and being quiet. And then I hear just a little, and I turn around, and it's this kid. I said, okay. I walk over there and I say, hey, what are you doing?
Nothing.
He's got something on the ground, cup, you know, it's cupped underneath. And I said, come on, hand it over. So he picks up this thing, puts it in my hand, and I look down at it, and I'm just observing it. That is human poop in my hand. And right at that moment, his class goes, and before I even calculate what's going on, I look up and he's already down the hallway. I'm like, this is gross. This is disgusting. Okay. So I go and I throw it away, and I go wash my hands and ask for leave, and my administrator didn't say I could have leave, so I stayed and taught the rest of my classes. And so I'm like, coach, you will not ever believe what that kid stuck in my hand. And she goes, what? He said, poop. And she goes, oh, like dog food, dog poop? I said, no, human poop rolled up in a ball. And she goes, oh, it was about this big. And so I'm, you know, I don't see the kid again. It was just second grade. So there's enough kids that have accidents. I'm sure they didn't want to stop playing or whatever. The next day, same kid, same problem, playing, except smart Mr. Bryant didn't remember that I had had this conversation with him yesterday. So again, he's batting something around, and I said, come and give me that. And right at that moment, I had the realization right as it's mid drop into my hand, and there is another one. And this time I said, dude, what is going on? Where is this coming from? And he goes, I just found it. And I said, found it where? This is 2 days in a row that you have found this. And so he goes, turns out he gives me some BS story, and I say, okay, I'm going to talk to your teacher. He had been using the restroom at PE in his drawers and had run around so much that he had these smooth stones that were falling out of his pants, and he would shake them out when they were in trouble. He'd shake them out so he would have something to play with. And so I said, buddy, you cannot be pooping in your pants. And you definitely cannot be putting human poop in people's head. You cannot have, don't do this ever again. And so that's about as close to a miscommunication that you can get. It is now famously, that story is famously called the Bison Biscuit, because that was our school mascot. That's the Bison Biscuit story. And so I had that same principal, her husband, who is a dear friend of mine as well. And he also was a principal. Now he's doing administration downtown for the school district that he's at. And he texted me the other day and he just goes, dude, I was just remembering the Bison Biscuit story and I'm rolling over in my life. I can't even believe there's I can't believe you let someone stick poop in your hand. And I said, he was very convincing second grader. I thought he was playing with rocks and it wasn't rocks. So
Bison Biscuits.
Yep. Don't avoid those Bison Biscuits. They are neither tasty nor fun.
So next question is, how do you inspire students who are struggling both academically and personally?
I just tell them that they're worthy. That's the thing that I've begun. The older I get, the sooner I start with that. Because it's oftentimes, that's the question.
Oh, yeah.
That's the issue. You're worthy.
And they're not hearing it like they should.
They don't ever hear it.
Yeah.
They if they have a rocky home life, if they have a circle, a village of friends that are around them, or a village of people that are supposed to be affirming the things that are good and wholesome in this world and in their life and that would make them better, they're not. If they have anything other than that, they're not hearing anything like that, because people don't think that way. I truly believe it's probably the worst. It's the worst problem that we have in our society today, is that people see so much that isn't true. They see so much that isn't true, and therefore they have no idea what is true, and then they don't speak truth. It's just,
I think social media, TikTok, all of that, I think all that plays into it. I mean, it's just, you know, creates a fantasy world that it's just not real. I mean, there's not, mm-hmm. and then you think, well, it's those kids that are not hearing it. No, it's every kid. I mean, even the kids that come from, you know, two family homes or two parent family, you know, to the what we would call the perfect little family. Yeah. Those kids are still not hearing, hey, you are worthy. You can do whatever you want to do. You can be whatever you want to be, and you don't have to be perfect all the time. You know.
Yeah, you can do the hard. You can, and I think that statement I just made was born out of COVID, where, you know, we were so concerned with the social emotional growth of our students that we then, instead of just saying, yes, it's hard for everybody. And you know what? It's hard for me to get out of bed and get anything but pajamas on while I'm trying to teach kindergartners music online. That's hard. That's hard to motivate parents and people to be online, to go to school. And we did ourselves we did probably the worst thing that education could have done during the pandemic, because we made it to where it wasn't as serious as we have always said education is. My entire existence prior to 2020 was, school is important. You need to be in school, and there's no facts that can differ from those two statements. It's important, and it's about you, and you need to do it. And it's so important that we're going to have police officers on the backside of it if you don't. I have friends of mine that got in trouble that were absent. They missed so many days, and they went and did time in jail. They didn't do time in jail, but they got arrested for truancy. And I've never seen that in my 12 years of teaching. I've never seen somebody outside of where there's a necessity to call for the safety of kids, a truancy officer. I don't even think our school district has a truancy officer. And so I'm sure that we do. I mean, they're just resource officers. They're called a different name, but they don't. We told them it's important, and then our actions spoke differently. And that's the thing that hurt. I don't know that we'll ever recover from that. From the top down, this is important. Oh, wait, no, it's not, because we're going to give you 40% off. We're going to give you, don't worry about attendance. We know life is hard. And I get that it was hard for everybody, But instead of making it important and making it a line that we can't cross, we just obliterated all the lines, and now we're trying to put it all back in the box, and we can't. So I, you know, that statement of our kids, knowing that they're worthy, knowing that a teacher thinks that, knowing that an administrator thinks that, but above that, knowing someone that's a good human being believes in them. That's the thing that's, I teach notes and rhythms. And if I never taught another note or rhythm, my students would know that about me, and they would know that hopefully about themselves, is that they are worth the risk. They are worth the hardship. They are worth the trouble that they're going to cause me. They're every ounce of effort that I put into them, even when they act like jack wagons and they might not be worthy, they're still worth every ounce of effort that we put into them.
Absolutely. That's why I think that what you do and that what I did and that, you know, what 1.6 million, I think, of us teaching is the most important job on the planet. And I know that I'm putting that, you know, doctors, lawyers, you know, Indian chiefs, everything into that, but I'm just telling you, I feel as strongly about the importance of teachers and teaching. And I'm not talking about teachers that teach the standards the best. I'm talking about teachers that do exactly what you've talked about this afternoon, make connections with kids, impact their lives, change the trajectory of their future. Don't browbeat them to death. Love kids. Have high expectations for them, but then provide the steps that they need to meet excellence, so they learn that, hey, for the rest of my life, I can.
Yeah, I can. I may not be your math student extraordinaire. Yeah. I may not be the most successful straight A student you've ever had. I may not be setting any records for the school in academics or in sports or anything like that. I am worthy, and I am worthy enough to try.
Yeah,
and if I try, I have a 50-50 chance, if not more than that, because I'm trying. I have at least a 50-50 chance of success, because it's either try or don't. And I know that that's a Star Wars reference, but, you know, do or do not. Try or don't. But it's a guaranteed failure that if you don't.
That's correct.
And it's 50-50 if you do. And if you put your whole heart and soul into something, it's more than that. I think you're stacking the odds in your favor.
All right, so our final question before we get to story time is, if teaching were a superhero job, what would your superpower be and how would you use it in the classroom?
Well, my fake superhero power, the one that doesn't really exist, and I'm super sad about it, is I wish that I had super speed. If I had super speed, I could think ahead, be ahead, go full flash over all of the kids. I make the mistake in the class. I say something dumb that I wish I could take back in time. I could run so fast and fast forward and turn back the world that I never said I would be the most brilliant person in the world, because I would have time and the ability to rewind it. So that would be my fake superpower. Would be super speed, just so that I could turn back time. And, there's an 80s or 70s song or something like that. But I think I did come up with a real superpower. And the one that I wish I had perfectly down, I wish I had humor and genuine love. I do have those things, but I wish I was a better comedian, and I wish that I wish I had more care, even the care that I have. I wish I was perfect in that genuine love. And that's the struggle that I'm always trying to find a way to create more, because I'm tired. I get tired and at the end of the day, and I don't support those kids as much as possible. You know, that's something that if I had my real superpower, I wish I could have that.
My problem is always, I've always cared too much. I just wish I didn't care so much. I just, you know, I cared too much. I'm just kidding. All right, so it's time for story time. This is where you get to tell any story that we left out, pranks. I have had some doozies of pranks over the years, anything like that. This is where you get to tell a story.
Well, I feel like that's what we've been doing this whole time. That's why
the whole time.
Like the format.
2 hours. It's probably going to be edited into two episodes.
Okay.
I don't have to delete anything.
I thought you were going to say it's probably going to be edited down to 2.5 minutes and then take out all the.
No, if I followed all the advice that if I were trying to build a YouTube channel, that it would be. But I'm not trying to build a YouTube channel. I'm trying to provide valuable content to teachers to understand that they are worth it, that they, you know, what they do is important and they're not in it alone.
No. And that's a thing that you really have to, you know, it takes a village. I hate that phrase so much because it's
Democrat.
Too basic. Well, and it's too basic. It really is too basic. What the heck? What does that even mean? You know, it takes a village. I think it takes people who it's deeper than that. It takes a family. And whether they look like you, whether they talk like you, whether they learn like you, teach like you, anything like that, you have to have people who are going to be of like mind and working towards similar goals in every situation. You know how hard that is. I mean, you were in the military. That's probably the most like mind thing that you could get where it's like forced like mind. You have to do this because it's this way and it's the rules and you're going to follow it.
You know,
right?
you bring that up, and I'll talk about that in just a second. The one thing that I do know, and I was Navy Reservist 22 years, so I've seen a thing or two. I was activated. I mean, I spent a little over 8 years, 2 weeks at a time on active duty. I do know that there are some things that I learned, that some strategies that after I've learned them, you know, I hear John Maxwell talking about them now as great leadership traits. But here's my role in the military was we were a shiploading and stowage specialist. So every time we went somewhere, we had a specific tasking to accomplish in a specific amount of time to accomplish it. Typically, it was unload a ship and load a ship back. And every ship was different. They had different. Anyway, the times when it went best, when that mission was the easiest for us to accomplish, was when they said, "Hey, here's your mission. You're the technical expert. You go do it. Tell us what you need." All right. Now, how does that portray? How does that have anything to do with education? The schools that get it have leaders that say, here's the mission, you know, 14 standards in mathematics, 11 standards in English. This is your timeline. You're the professional. Tell me what you need. Go do it.
Yep. Those are the best bosses I've ever worked for are the ones that it wasn't that they never said no.
That's correct.
That they always listened.
And, yeah, that's right.
And when you listen, when you get a boss that you can listen to, that will listen to you. I don't care if they say no to me. They listened and they understood and they comprehended what I was trying to do. And it just might not be the right time. There just might not be enough money. There just might not be enough of whatever. There might not be personnel. You know, there may be things that I don't see, or there certainly are things that I don't see as teacher that they're trying to stack. You know,
best ones will share those reasons why.
Yes. Yeah.
But if they don't, even though, you know, whether they do or don't share the reasons why, if you've got the kind of relationship where, you know, they trust you to do the job that they ask you to do and they trust you enough to listen to you through it, you'll just do it because they said so.
Yep.
But they have to earn that.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. I've been very blessed. I can't say that I've worked for, and knock on wood, I can't say that I have worked for many bad bosses. I know there's one that was the chief complaint that I had. The one year that I like to tell funny stories, but this one is not a funny story. This was, so get this, Uncle Glenn. You tell me from a person who's around administration, and who's taught and you've seen all facets of the gambit. I am in my seventh year teaching. I am leaving a job at elementary school, going to a middle school. I've interviewed for this job. It is now this middle school is a college preparatory success academy. And you know that just basically means it's taken over by a private company or charter school. It used to be Odessa High School, then it moved to Ector Middle School, and then it scored so poorly over a course of several years in Texas that the state comes in and, or the risk is that the state comes in and takes over. Well, in order to keep that from happening to the district, they sold, or a company out of Texas Tech came and basically oversaw the building of this charter school. And so it was called Ector College Preparatory Success Academy. And EPC had lost almost all of their fine arts. They had only kept one harp teacher. They used to be the fine arts magnet before we got there. They'd lost, so they kept the harp teacher and they kept the mariachi teacher and they kept the guitar teacher. So we're hiring, or at this time they were hiring band, assistant band, choir, orchestra, piano, and kind of buffering some of the other, but they were hiring all five of those. They hired the head band director who was fresh out of, he'd spent 3 years teaching prior. He's a great guy, great band director, great teacher. Hired me as the assistant. Again, I'd been teaching all of 6 years. They hired another brand new orchestra teacher. She had good pedigree and good all of that. She was going to do choir and band, and they were looking for a piano teacher. This facilitates all of these, about 800 students between those five teachers. They told us, they hired band, assistant band, they told us 2 weeks before school opens, hey, your numbers are too low. You're going to have to get the band numbers up for us to keep you both full-time band. Said, great, we'll do that. I looked at him and I said, I don't know how we're going to do that. He goes, we're going to have to figure it out. We went to the first open house. By the end of it, we had over 350 students in band signed up for the course. So that's enough for two teachers if it was an administrator who's going to listen, right? We did exactly what we told. I tell you, Uncle Glenn, at that night, I could have sold ketchup to a lady in white gloves. I mean, it was like, hey, you're missing arms. Come join band. We'll stick you on drum set.
Everybody's like, Glenn Miller that night. Yeah.
I don't care who you are. You are signed up for band by the end of it, buddy. And we met him at the door. We walked him all the way through the thing and to the band thing. And I was bringing him in, man. Like butterflies in a net. Most of them didn't even know what they were signing up for. Yeah. Like this guy. He's nice. He gave me a popsicle. You know, we did everything. And so that was 2 weeks into class, or 2 weeks before classes start. I get told a week before, yeah, you've got 350 students. You're still going to have to teach the piano classes. That's 80 students that I've got, three classes. You'll teach five band classes and three piano classes. I said, am I going to get a prep period to do any of this? No, you're going to sell back your prep period. Okay, that's fine. I can work with that. Let's roll. So that's what we were on day one. Day one happens. Choir orchestra teacher does not show up. Didn't tell anyone she's not showing up. She had taken a job in Midland, which is 20 minutes away, without telling anybody that she had taken this job. And so we're stuck. I go and with that prep period, I leave one of the band classes I was teaching. And I go and do orchestra and choir, bounce back and forth. There's about 200 kids in the choir. There was about 60 kids in the orchestra program. And we're just teaching it. And I walked into the principal, and this goes back to the story or to the point we were making earlier. I walked back into that principal and I said, Mr. Q, I have band, high brass, low brass, French horns, saxophone class. I'm going to have to, and clarinets. I'm going to have to take the two woodwind classes and put choir in one and orchestra in one if we're going to be doing that. And then on top of that, I've got the three piano classes that we're going to teach. And he goes, well, that's fine. And I said, no, it's not really fine. What are we going to do about getting a teacher in here? And he goes, oh, well, we're looking into that. We're looking for a teacher. We did not hire another teacher the entire school year. I went and found a retired choir teacher to come in and take those classes. And she just taught the three classes of choir, the 200 kids of choir. And all while she was working out, she had a rare blood cancer. And she was going through chemotherapy. So I would go and substitute for her classes when she couldn't make it. But all of that to say, I never once was listened to by that teacher or by that principal. And I went as far as to go and talk to Fine Arts. Well, it's a charter school. I went and talked to the unions. Well, sorry, that's a charter school. I went and talked to that. And I'm like, this is not what I signed up for. Well, you got a 10% raise. Well, this is not, I don't care if I was making $1 million. This is not what we're supposed to be doing if we're loving on kids. If we're teaching people and we're teaching kids how to do things, like, this doesn't work. This is not working. I'm doing $1 million worth of work. Are you willing to pay? Oh, well, we can't pay you for that.
Yeah, no.
Well, so it's stories like that. It's things like that. And I saw that for the first time in my entire career, why people leave it after 5 years. Why? Because crap like that happens all the time.
Yeah.
People get in sideways and admin doesn't listen and try and fix it.
And I'm just going to roll out a guess here that the admin was probably a former coach and probably yeah. had not ever been in the band and didn't understand how important fine arts were.
Yeah. Well, that middle school had 1,400 students in it. It was the largest middle school in Texas. And there was people, I mean, he was a coach, but he was a veteran. He was a veteran principal. He had been Odessa High School's principal, assistant principal over in various places. He had worked in admin and he was just, I think he was up a creek without a paddle. And and he didn't have anything to do with the charter so yeah, that's. Well,
I think I could stay on here all night, but I couldn't stay on here all night. I have enjoyed catching up with you. Do you have anything else for the good of the cause?
Well, this has been Teacher's Tales. I have very much enjoyed.
Well, I've enjoyed interviewing, talking to you tonight.
Teachers, keep your head up. It's all going to be okay. You may save some kids. You will not save all of them. And it is your goal, should be your goal, to be a light in darkness, because there's a lot of dark. And if it just takes a little bit of light to obliterate the darkness. So that's my last thing. Keep plugging away, guys.
Until next time, yeah, this has been Teacher Tales.